today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
This next song is alongside Samuel Barber's Adagio and the theme song from Chariots of Fire, one of the most brilliant, innovative, ingenious, and audacious pieces of music ever presented by man.
Hello, everybody. This is Mike Wagner, and we are sitting in for Jim and Patrick, and the we is also includes Mr.
Nick Scalera.
Hello, my friend. Nice to see you again.
Good to be here.
We are recording at my house, live and in person, not like back in the day when we used to have to do it over Zoom. So this is really great. We've done, this is probably our, I don't know, third, fourth, fifth, something.
Yeah, something like that.
Over here.
It's been enough for an album side.
And B-sides.
B-sides. Right.
So today our topic is an album by R.E.M., who last year won the March Madness Countdown.
Tournament.
That's the basketballs, right? Okay. And when I not too long ago, I went to some friends of ours from the community here, Kevin Goff, Rob Gates, and Mike Snyder. We went and saw the Baseball Project, which has... Peter Buck and Mike Mills, and when I went up to him and asked, hey, how was it when you won the Rockin' the Suburbs March Madness Countdown? Wasn't that great?
The highlight of our career.
I was totally like Chris Farley. do you remember when?
Exactly.
Anyway, we're going to talk about the album Green today. I don't remember how we came up with this topic, but we thought it would be interesting. Do you remember?
I mean, I think the discussion was, we were both talking about our feelings about this album in the sense that it's not everyone's favorite album. It's not often sort of cited at the top of their list, but that it was an album that had an impact on both of us, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So let's go ahead and start by you providing a little background on the album and that sort of thing, like where they were in their career at the time and all that sort of good stuff.
Sure.
Do that voodoo that you do.
Let's do the thing. So, yeah, I'm assuming, again, the Rock in the Suburbs audience has heard of the band R.E.M.
They won the countdown.
That's
what I hear.
So you know who they are. At this point, so in the lead up to the recording of Green, the band had actually kind of broken through into mainstream popularity. They had their first major chart success with Document, which is another great album put out in 1987.
Very great
album. Very fine piece of work. It reached number 10 in the U.S. and went platinum. And the single, The One I Love, went to number 9. And of course, also The End of the World as We Know It was also on there. It got a lot of MTV airplay. So also of note, around this time, Mike might remember this, they were on the cover of Rolling Stone.
Yes, they were. America's Greatest Band.
America's Greatest Band. So this is, they are at the big time, certainly much more of a big time than they probably ever imagined they would have when they were playing at the, you know, 40-watt club in Athens, Georgia in 81, whatever it was. Document was a bit of a move towards more of a mainstream sound. It was a harder, cleaner rock sound compared to, you know, Mike and I, obviously, and I'm sure many in the Rock in the Suburbs community dearly love those first three or four jangly albums, but Document was a bit of a departure from that. The other thing of note at this point, that with the release of Document, they had fulfilled their commitment to IRS Records, which was, I guess, the biggest independent label at the time.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, very successful label.
You know, and R.E.M. was frustrated with IRS because they didn't feel that they were actually a big priority at our IRS, and they got pretty much zero distribution overseas. And it's interesting. I was watching actually some YouTube videos by a couple of British fans, and they specifically mentioned that they had no knowledge of R.E.M. before Green. That because the albums just were not distributed that well there. They moved over to major label Warner at a deal estimated at $6 to $12 million. I remember that being a huge, gigantic number at the time, right? They would go on to sign a much bigger deal years later, but this $6 to $12 million was a big deal. Of course, Warner was an artist-friendly label, so they did guarantee REM artistic freedom. It's hard to imagine REM having any other way of recording an album. So now they are on a major label. They've had their first major breakthrough. Where are they going to go with this next album? The interesting thing about this is it wasn't probably really a progression in terms of document, because the album has a bit of a middling reputation. I think there's kind of mixed feelings even at the time, and the critical response. A lot of publications, you know, who do lists of the greatest REM albums, it's always kind of ranked in the middle somewhere. Green is ranked, for example, NME put it at number 9, Spin put it at number 10, Pop Matters number 10, and Consequence of Sound number 9.
Well, our resident REM expert, Craig Rosen, who I texted before this, and I said, what's your thoughts on it? And he said, I like it, but I'd say lower middle part of their catalog. So he's right in line.
He's right in line with the experts, NME and the Spins and all those other sort of things. But I don't think, you know, Mike, we're
pitchfork calls for Craig.
Right. I don't think we're necessarily here to say that Green was the greatest thing that REM ever put out there, but we do both feel it's an important album and it had a big impact on us personally, and that it's got some amazing songs on it. It is an interesting and it's a fairly eclectic mix of songs, but there's some great stuff on there, and that's what we want to talk about today.
Yeah. As Nick said, they really stepped away from the jangly Rickenbacker sound quite a lot. Out of Time is sort of, which is the album after this one, which had Losing My Religion, is generally regarded like, whoa, they start breaking out into different stuff. And it's like, actually, that's not quite right, because it actually happened a lot more, even more so than on Out of Time, because there's actually three songs that are like all acoustic, you know, and you got, I forget, how many of the man on, I think a couple
mandolins,
of mandolins.
Yeah, and a few songs.
And he got rid of he did not use the Rickenbacker. He didn't get rid of it. But he started using, of all things, which was kind of surprising, he started using a Les Paul, which is known like as the rock god of guitar.
Chunky, yeah.
And he started doing windmills and, no, I'm kidding. And
no. He does jump around a lot, so.
But it gave him a totally different sound. And so why don't we just go ahead and jump into the music? And then we'll come back and cover some of these things we won't cover. But just to go a good example of like the big change is the song Get Up.
Yes.
So
let's listen to that.
Okay, so that's quite different than, Perfect Circle or
Radio Free Europe.
Yeah,
you know, it's way
different.
Yeah.
You know, big sort of power chords, this sort of thing, and big drum sound that, not quite 80s production, but you know, just a bigger drum sound as opposed to thing of like the. But it, to be fair, it did change before we got here. But it's more sort of that modern drum sound, and the other thing, as always, what didn't change is those Mike Mills backing vocals are just like, go back and listen to it. It's like he does that really way up ahead, and he just hits that.
Oh, it's
high
that fabulous call and response going on.
Yeah,
there between
they still, but yeah, I personally, I love this song. You know, I think
it's a flat out rocker, and it's, you know, that's we kind of kick the album off with two big rockers here, and that's what we'll kind of see in this album, is that there's there's like three sort of song styles, and this one really sort of puts a flag in the ground for like, we're gonna rip this joint with this song. But also, I mean, the other thing that's worth noting here is that, like, pretty simple lyrics, pretty straightforward. You know exactly what Michael Stipe is saying. There's no mumbling. Apparently he did write this about Mike Mills, that Mike was asleep at, you know, they were in a recording studio, and like, and Stipe was writing, which, you know, that was usually their process, right? The Mills, Barry, and Buck would write the backing tracks, and then Stipe would put lyrics on top of them. But apparently, Mills didn't know about this until many years later, and was not too super thrilled when he found out this song was about him. But his vocal performance on it is fantastic. I think Mike Mills really shines in this album in general. And I think what you see is, you sort of, as R.E.M. became more popular, I think you see Mills just kind of step to the forefront a little bit. You hear the bass, you hear more the vocal, that he shares more vocals, he takes some more lead vocals. I think that's part of what's going on here. And that's also part of the lore of this album that we might as well bring up here, was this idea that they wanted to change things up, that they literally sat down before recording this album, we want to change things up. And one of the things that they did, and this is sort of the big myth that may or may not be true, that they switched instruments, right? That there was a lot of instrument switching going around. You had
every band says that,
right? But whether that happened or not, I think we will hear as we listen to this that they certainly were trying to break out of their mold. There's right. No doubt about that.
So let's, with that in mind, let's go to the next song I'm going to talk about, yep. Which is Hair Shirt, which is sort of the other thing about this album that was said, was that they were going to have one side electric and one side acoustic. The problem being that I read that there wasn't enough acoustic material to fill up a side. So there's kind of this, we'll come back to talk about that after we listen to a song called Hair. We're going to play The Wrong Child first.
Okay.
This is a song called The Wrong Child.
I've watched the children come and go.
Oh, I picked this song because this is often, so we talk about this album not being that popular to people. This is probably the least popular song on this album, and I think, I don't agree with it. I think this is a great song. We really hear the first sort of full out, not the first, but you hear this, we hear the mandolin in there. A lot of people thought the mandolin didn't come until Out of Time. Well, it's clearly in this song.
Right.
We hear Michael Stipe's vocals sound, I just think, absolutely fantastic.
Far more upfront than he...
Very much
upfront.
I mean,
there was, like, if you listen, there was, like, the two vocals.
He was double tracking, sort of, like, calling and responding with his own voice, which is, I think, is a really... really cool technique. I think in general, Mike, you know, Stipe becomes more and more confident as a vocalist, I think. And he's really, you know, there was a time back in the early days when you know, people would accuse him of mumbling. What is he saying? You know, whatever. Lyrics were mysterious. I like that a lot about the early lyrics. I know Mike does too. A lot of us in the community probably love those early songs where you didn't know what he was talking about. It was a moral kiosk or it was whatever the hell it was. But they always presented some sort of like an emotion or a scene that you can put yourself into.
I always used to say, I have no idea what he's talking about, and I really love those lyrics.
Right. That's how I feel. You could put yourself into them and you can kind of like try to.
There's always these really great turns of phrases like follow the leader, run, turn into butter. I'm like, that's awesome. Right, I don't know why I love it, but I do.
Yeah. I mean, you know, with some of those choruses are just very odd, you know, odd phrasings of lyrics. That was the whole thing. You know, in the words of today's youth, they were very vibey. Those early, I said this earlier, there was all vibes because you didn't know for sure what he was saying.
Nick got an eye roll over that.
Yeah, I did. But the kids love that term. But anyway, but I
big audience in the Rock in the Suburbs podcast is the kids.
The kids love us. We're big with the Gen Zs. But anyway, I think this is a really powerful song. I think that as Michael Stipe's voice becomes clearer, more upfront, his lyrics become more direct. I don't think the emotional impact is, if anything, probably greater than on some of the earlier albums. And I think that this is a really sad song. It's about a, you know, the lyrics are pretty obvious. You don't have to read too much. Here's a kid who's got some sort of affliction and he's isolated and he's alone. And it's sad at the end. Michael Stipe just like rips that, you know, that sort of ending line where he says it's okay. And it's, I'm going to try to imitate it, but like he says it like six times and it's, he'd never really done anything like that. I don't think.
Yeah.
He's put himself out there.
It's really quite
edge.
Different from everything else in her catalog. Don't you think? I mean, this was really, I mean, I didn't hear it and go, oh my God, this is so different. I mean, I didn't think that. I was just like, oh, I like this song as well. I mean, I think it's really, really good. The next song we wanted to talk about is a song called Turn You Inside Out. And this is one of my favorite. And Nick and I have been talking about this. And I saw REM on the Green Tour. And luckily, I got to sit fifth row. I actually saw them twice. I sat fifth row and second row. And it was awesome. And seeing a band that, because I had seen them before, but I sat like in the second deck and it's like, in, you know, but, and on this tour, it was very, very big tour, right? They added another guitar player, Pete Holzapfel from DBs, was it?
I think so.
I think it was the DBs. And they played the song early in the set and I was just could not believe this. It was just so good. And he did, and if he, I can't recommend enough, go on YouTube. Find the videos from Tour Film about this. We should probably talk about that in a little bit, but let's go ahead and play Turn You Inside Out right now. And it was just a great, great live song. So that's a pretty bombastic song, right?
Yeah.
And also Michael Stipe, he took to like doing this really crazy dancing during this tour, and he would do the megaphone, he would do the I Can Turn You Inside Out. It was great. It was a really, really, really great song live.
Yeah. I mean, by this time in their career, Michael Stipe would literally just command the audience.
Yeah.
I mean,
couldn't take your eyes off him. You just could not take your eyes off him. Again, the drum sounds were pretty big.
Yep.
right? I mean, not in a bad way, not like in a bombastic way. I mean, it's sort of a bombastic song. I mean, but it's not like over the top, big 80s drums where it's just like on the snare drum or anything like that. Again, the Les Paul guitar, you could really very clearly hear that it's not a Rickenbacker, right?
Yeah. It's an anti-Rickenbacker, yeah. If anything else.
So anyway, I think that's really great thing. Like you were saying, people said in Monsters when they start doing this, it's like, no, not really. I mean,
it's a tough song. It's kind of, it's a little bit of a mean song. You know what I mean? Which is not usually what you also expect from REM. It's kind of like, it's an FU song basically in a lot of ways. And it's kind of someone like feeling their own power of manipulation and being like, okay with it. So it's lyrically interesting. It's musically different. And that's a lot of what you get on Green. It's definitely one of the rockers on the album. There's three or four rockers. Three or four acoustic numbers, and then there's some that kind of sit in between.
Right. So let's talk about another one of the acoustic songs. You it's him. So you were picking the acoustic song.
Yeah.
So the next song we're going to talk about is a song called Hair Shirt. Nick picked the song. You picked the acoustic songs, and I picked the big loud songs, the par for the course. You want to talk about it first, then we'll play it?
I mean, I just think this is a really interesting song. The lyrics, I had to look up what a hair shirt is, you know.
I remember Googling a long time ago. I sort of interpreted it as being like sort of a religious thing.
Right? It is kind of like a self-flagellation kind of thing, yeah. Which, you know, once you know that unlocks the rest of the song But yeah, it's just another really emotive song, another extremely emotive vocal performance from Michael Stipe. I love the acoustic stuff. I love that vibe, you know? So, I think it's another sort of.
Because you're chill.
Well, I mean.
You got a vibe. Chill vibe.
I would say that, yes, I have a chill vibe. But I also say as an REM fan, especially one that, you know, I started with REM in 1985, and I was dearly, you know, the Fables of the Reconstruction. I was deeply, deeply in love of the jangly kind of stuff. I think for me, as we get up into Document and into Green, like the acoustic stuff is a little easier of a transition for me than the kind of thing we just heard, which is like REM being like a kick-ass like power chord rock band. That was a little harder for me to go, so I just sort of gravitate to some of these more acoustic things,
which is weird because we're both big Who fans. It's like, right. You know, nothing like a big Pete Townsend, you know?
Right? Of course. So like, but that wasn't REM, right? For all those years, that was, they were sort of the antithesis of that kind of thing for a while. But and then they when they embraced it and decided to do it, they did a damn good job of it.
Yeah. Okay, so this is in Hair Shirt.
I am not the type of dog that could keep you waiting for no good reason. Run a carbon black test on my jaw, and you will find it's all been said. I can swing my megaphone and long arm the rest. It's easier and better to just beat it from the chest. Of desire, I could walk into this room. Waves of conversation are enough to knock you down.
All right. Very big thanks there to Mike Wagner and Nick Scalera for putting together this episode. And guess what, folks? It's not over yet. That's right. We'll have the second part of this episode coming up on Friday of this week. So I eagerly look forward to that. Well, I've already heard it, but it's really good. So you should eagerly look forward to it as well. but no, it's really nice to hear these guys with obvious deep knowledge about the band and the album and the way their career evolved go in and talk about this record on the Warner Brothers label, 1998. So get yourself prepared, folks. Tomorrow we've got another update from our American 1970s album bracket madness poll countdown challenge that's coming up tomorrow, and want everybody to tune into that as we get closer and closer to the big showdown. Who's it going to be, and who's going to come out on top? These matchups in the Sweet 16 have been incredibly close, and I hope everybody's enjoying it, and thanks to everyone who's been voting. It's really, really much appreciated. And with that, we will sign off for today and tell you that we will talk to you guys tomorrow.
Oh, you used to say, I have no idea what he's talking about, and I really love those lyrics.